are a nonprofit, nonpartisan policy research organization based in Washington, D.C., and our mission is to promote the economic vitality and environmental sustainability of the Northeast Midwest region of the U.S., and we work in close cooperation with a coalition on the Senate and the House that's called the Northeast Midwest Coalition, and they've been around since the late 1970s, and so has my organization. And for the organization, I mostly work on older cities-related issues and policies. So this talk is going to be based on dissertation research, which I conducted in 2008 and 2009, surrounding the Hill District CBA, or the One Hill Coalition CBA with the Penguins and the city and the county. So I'll give you a little bit of a roadmap. First, I'm going to review some literature on stadiums, on community benefits agreements, and I'm going to place them into the context of both post-industrial urban redevelopment and a theory called the growth machine theory. Second, I'll describe the case study on which my findings were based, which is a case study of the first CBA that was signed in Pittsburgh in 2008 surrounding the Consol Energy Center. Third, I will address the following research question. What are the implications of CBAs for pro-growth agendas? And I'll explain what that means. And fourth, I'm going to suggest avenues for a larger, what I call, deconstruction of growth, as well as avenues for further research. And also, I encourage you, if you have questions or want anything to be clarified or need me to speak louder or slower, please let me know. It actually makes me more comfortable if you want to interject so it's more of a discussion. Okay, so first of all, some of you may already be familiar with the concept or the theory of the growth machine, but some of you may have never heard of this before. So, the growth machine theory was established or conceived of in the late 1970s by a sociologist by the name of Harvey Mulloch. And he described the city as a growth machine. And so what he said is that this growth machine was an apparatus of interlocking pro-growth associations and governmental units united behind the doctrine of value-free development. So I'm going to break that up because it's really jargony. So the very first part, this notion of interlocking associations and governmental units, is basically just referring to the local corporate community, media, possibly utility companies, and the local government. Sometimes that city could be city and county. The second part, pro-growth. What they mean by, or what he meant by pro-growth, is the idea that this association or this alliance between the local corporate community and the government want to achieve growth, and they want to achieve growth in terms of population, in terms of basic industry, labor force, commerce, financial activity, and land use. So, growth is the ultimate goal, and they're ultimately interested in the profit potential of land use and of property. And this is something that is a kind of a Marxist concept of the idea of exchange value, which some of you may already be familiar with. So again, this group of people, this association, is interested in growing everything, growing the city in terms of population, labor force, jobs, land use, etc. And then finally, value-free. So the last part is value-free development. This part means that it's the belief that land use should be determined by the market, by the free market, only by the free market, and again, the pursuit of profit and the profit potential of land. So value-free, meaning that it's without consideration for any other factors, such as the way in which the development of land could negatively impact people or communities. Any questions? The basis of everything, so make sure we're on the same page. Okay, so what do we know about the growth machine and urban stadium building? So starting in the 1990s, or since the 1990s really, there's been a boom in the construction of urban sports facilities. And there are two sociologists by the name of Delaney and Eckstein who have done a ton of work on this. And basically they apply growth machine theory to the construction of sports facilities. And what they say is that stadium building, and this is my word in here, but it basically typifies or is like the perfect example of the way that the growth machine acts or the growth machine behaves in cities today. And that's because this is what's going on in cities today. There's an emphasis on attracting people who are wealthy, people who are middle class or tourists into the city center through attractions like sports facilities. It also typifies growth processes because this emphasis is indicative of something called the symbolic economy. This is a concept by Sharon Zukin, and what she says is that basically we have an economy right now that's based on consumption and not necessarily on production. And I think like the perfect example of this in Pittsburgh is if you look at the waterfront. So if you're familiar with the waterfront, you know, it used to be this place of industrial production, and now it's entirely a place of consumption. So we shop at the waterfront now. We don't make things there. All right, it's not entirely shopping, mostly shopping. And then lastly, this sort of coincides with something called a global trope. And this is an idea by a scholar named David Wilson. And he refers to the global trope as sort of like a rhetoric that surrounds globalization right now. And the rhetoric is basically saying that we have all these older cities that are decaying, and they must be in competition with one another to compete for scarce resources. And they need to do that by attracting things like sports facilities into their downtowns. Okay? So all these things are sort of working together to show how stadium building is really a perfect example of growth in today's cities and what growth is driven by. And lastly, the Local Growth Coalition, which is sort of like what makes up this growth machine, this alliance between the corporate community and the local government, they often argue that stadium buildings are urban saviors. So the idea that you have a stadium come in and it's going to save the downtown or it's going to save the city, it's going to be this great economic boom. The problem is they're not really urban saviors. Most of the literature is basically saying that stadiums are not the urban saviors that they're purported to be when it comes to economics, and that they actually offer very few long-term, high-paying jobs, and that the jobs are short-term. There's sort of like a honeymoon period at the arena when it opens or the stadium when it opens, and then attendance drops off unless you have this really great team. There's also more one-stop shopping inside these new arenas, so you have fewer people going to businesses outside the arena, but everything's going on inside. And there's another, trying to remember what the other things are. Oh, another thing is that they're very much catering toward a wealthy fan base. So these new arenas and stadiums have fewer just mass seating, but they have more luxury boxes, for example. So they're not necessarily the urban saviors that they're purporting to be. That's the main point. Okay, so what do we know about community engagement with the growth machine? The initial theory basically says that there's this inherent tension between the growth machine and the community, between the folks who are out for profit potential of land use and people who see land as more about its informal support networks, its local goods and services, as a source of pride and identity. And so that's referred to as use value. So we have exchange value versus use value. And over the years, that dichotomy has been sort of negated, but I'm not going to get into that. That's more academic. Nevertheless, we see this tension in a couple, many examples throughout history. For example, we see the tension between growth machine and community in the histories of urban renewal and in the history of revitalization and the ever-present push to revitalize downtowns through things like sports facilities. And the result in many of these cases is that you have the most negative impact on incomes, on residents that are low income and that are often racial ethnic minorities. And so that may mean that they were forcibly displaced. It may mean that they are unable to afford living costs as they rise. And it may mean that they are disproportionately exposed to environmental hazards. Okay, so the literature on the growth machine and community engagement is really focused on opposition. So how communities are opposing the growth machine or opposing redevelopment projects in their backyard. And the literature tells us that in cities that have very strong local growth coalitions, opposition tends to fail. And we see this especially in the case of stadium building, Because even where opponents managed to get a referendum, to win a referendum about public funding, stadiums were still built with public funds, and that happened right here in Pittsburgh in the late 1990s when we went to Plan B in order to build Heinz and PNC. Both of those were built in some part with public funding, even though there was a referendum saying, no, we don't want the boost in our taxes. So you probably remember that if you lived here at that time. So given that the community's opposition to growth machine tends to fail, they're turning to new strategies. And so that's where the community benefits agreement comes in, because it's a strategy that uses the negotiation approach as opposed to just the purely oppositional one. And so I think that CBAs present an interesting addition to this literature, because they talk about negotiation and not just opposition. So just a few words here about community benefits agreements in case you're not familiar with them. CBAs are contracts between private developers and community-based coalitions. They are negotiated in such a way that the community says, we'll give you public support for your project if you give us XYZ benefits. And the benefits don't have to be directly about the development project. They can be more wide-ranging. And they tend to be things like targeted hiring, environmental improvements, job training programs, affordable housing, or funding for local goods and services. Additionally, a true CBA, what a CBA should be, is both inclusive and enforceable. And what is meant by that is inclusive means it's made up of a community coalition, so a coalition of many organizations working together, and enforceable meaning that it's legally binding. That basically each party, if they don't hold up their end of the bargain, can sue. And that carries on to successors, tenants, etc.
You mentioned that the CBAs in the world are in the what the community offers to developers is public support?
Public support and not protesting, because that could be very costly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Are there negative incentives? Have you seen that? How much does public matter?
Yeah. Well, like I said, I think there's two sides to the coin. So public support, but also promising not to sue for the development or go and lay down in front of the construction or anything like that. So sometimes that's enough, because that would be costly and it would cause delays. That's my understanding. That really is the leverage that communities have. But I'll get into other examples of what makes them have more or less leverage. But yeah, that is what they get. That's what the agreement says. Public support in return for these other benefits. Yeah.
Can you talk about the
enforcement?
What is the impact on the state? They're negotiating now what to do with the housing.
Yeah. Well, that, Gene, you're getting to my conclusion. The notion that it's reactive is one of the things I'm going to bring up. Exactly. Oh, that's perfect. We're on the same page. Okay, so let's see. So they're legally enforceable. The other thing is that they're still relatively rare in the U.S. There is maybe 25 to 50 of them in the U.S., depending on whose number you're looking at. They're increasingly being negotiated and signed, though, and they're probably, I would say, more common on the West Coast, especially California. And CBAs and sports facilities are kind of interesting. Pittsburgh was just one of a handful of agreements surrounding sports facilities. They were also signed in Los Angeles and San Diego and in New York City. But the ones in New York City are sort of fraught with criticism because they don't fit that inclusive and enforceable standard. Also, with sports facilities, communities might be able to gain a little bit more leverage than they would in other places or in other situations, because not only are there a lot of public subsidies, which I mentioned earlier, but also stadiums are large and often place-specific, so they can't just get up and move somewhere where CBAs are not. Okay, so this wasn't my entire research question for my dissertation, but these were questions that fueled one of my chapters. So what does it mean for this, what does this relatively new community strategy, the CBA, mean for pro-growth agendas and value-free growth? And what can one learn about pro-growth dynamics from community attempts to negotiate with the growth machine or coalition? So despite the fact that scholars have engaged with the growth machine theory for like 3 decades, they really haven't talked about negotiation, and they really haven't fully explored the relationship between community organizing and the growth machine. So that was the rationale behind these questions and this part of my research. And the case study that contributes to my findings here is, as I mentioned, the case study of the Hill District CBA. And what I did to study this CBA process was I engaged in 2 main methods. I'm just going to briefly go into my methods in case some of you are interested in methods. I engaged in interviewing and ethnographic field work. I did in-depth face-to-face interviews with 32 involved stakeholders from all around the issue. 19 of 32 of them lived in the Hill District. I also engaged in a year of participant observations at meetings and events and collected a lot of data in terms of like flyers and meeting minutes and everything, you know, that I wasn't actually there for part of the process. I have lots of files of information. And I analyzed the data through something called a constructivist ground theory approach, for some of you that now already know that, that approach, and it was aided by a software program called Atlas TI, and I had several layers of coding, and I painstakingly transcribed the interview data myself. Just going to add that. Okay, so...
We can promote it because we have a qualitative data center.
It was painful. So the case study location is the Hill District neighborhood. This is a map of the Hill District neighborhood where my study took place. And I think the most important thing here, which most of you already know, is that the Hill District is very centrally located, where we have the Central Business District and the Oakland neighborhood. So if we were to map the Hill District, there's sort of like 2 definitions depending on who you ask. There's a smaller definition that includes these census tracts from Crawford Waters up to the Upper Hill. And if you have a greater Hill District definition, it also includes Uptown, which is a census tract that includes downtown. The majority of the community is African American, but this particular census tract has a larger population that's white. For the sake of brevity, and because many of you are already familiar with the Hill District, I'm not going to go into a lot of details about the demographics of it or describe it, but I'm going to attempt to just give a very brief snapshot, and I hope I'm doing it justice. So the majority of the community is characterized by high levels of poverty, renter-occupied housing, and a decrease in population, and that's left many properties vacant and deteriorating. At the same time, though, the Hill District is on the verge of transition, and many of my participants mentioned this, that you have these decades of disinvestment and the realities of poverty, crime, and drugs that's also coexisting with new changes, like new housing, other redevelopment projects besides the arena, like the YMCA, the library, and the grocery store. And you also have increasing racial and class diversity in certain parts of the Hill District. And also some renaming, I call it euphemistic renaming, to sort of market parts of the Hill in new ways. So recently, the Hill District faced its most substantial redevelopment challenge since the late 1950s. And in the late 1950s, as many of you know, urban renewal caused a major amputation of the Lower Hill District. And so in 1956, these are before and after of the renewal. So when the first arena went in, Civic Arena, many of you have already seen these photos. On the left, we have the overlay of the Civic Arena before the renewal happened, and you can see how densely populated the area was. And then after the renewal, this picture on the right, you see the Civic Arena had demolished a lot of land, 8,000 people displaced, and 413 businesses displaced in a 100-acre area. And it created a buffer between the downtown area and the Lower Hill District. Some of it remained sort of a sea of parking lots, as many of them are for many years. So, again, this sort of new redevelopment challenge that faced the Hill. In 2007, yeah. 413 is the number I've seen. So in 2007, the city announced that a new arena would be constructed across the street from the old arena. And that would be in time for the 2010-11 hunting season. And if you recall, this was in response to the Penguins threatening to leave the city because they wanted a new arena. I thought that it would be worth putting the funding details in here because I think it's relevant for, you know, the continuation of the talk. So can you see the bottom there? Okay. So the cost at the beginning was $290 million, and it went up to $320 million. And that was fueled by, I'll make sure I'm getting this right, funded by a 30-year revenue bond issue and backed by annual payments of $7.5 million from the state, $7.5 million from casino revenue, and Penguins would pay an annual rent of $4.1 million. Additionally, when that cost went up from $290 to $321, the Penguins contributed a flat rate of $15.5 million, the state $10 million, and the SCA, which is the Sports and Exhibition Authority, which is a city-county entity, contributed $5.5 million. So even though no major residential displacement was necessary to make room for this new arena, residents and members of businesses and organizations were determined to benefit. They formed a broad-based coalition to become part of the redevelopment conversation through the negotiation of the CBA. The outcome was that in August of 2008, the CBA was signed, and it was signed between the city, the county, the Penguins, and the One Hill Coalition, which was made up of, at one point, it boasted about 100 members, representatives of different organizations and businesses, etc. So in return for public support of the project, the benefits that that the community received, there was a series of them. I think the key ones that are worth mentioning are the money towards a grocery store. It was $2 million, meaning $1 million from the Penguins and $1 million from the city, as well as a first source hiring center so that people that visited the First Source Center in the Hill District would be given first shot at jobs in the arena. And also city funding for a master planning process, which would inform the redevelopment of the 28 acres where the Civic Arena stood, which became the Mellon Arena, and which is now no longer. Yeah.
Just a point, just a little discussion about that. First Source Center is
a venture for the
public
jobs.
Okay.
It's back up again.
Is it? Okay.
It's still going. There is it.
It's buffering and it's growing.
Okay.
Where is it? In the book.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't have the update on it. So, also, I wanted to note that if you do want to find out, I'm not going to talk about the CBA process itself, but if you do want to read more or find out more about the CBA process, there are two local practitioner scholars that have written about it, and that includes Dr. Emily Castarby, who's here, and Dr. Bonnie Young-Lang. They both wrote about the CBA process and have things published about it. I'm going to be focusing on the growth machine. So, just to give you again spatially, so we had Site A, which is where the Mellon Arena stood, the Civic Arena, the Mellon Arena, now no longer, and B, you can see how close they were. We have where the Mellon Arena stands. And then an image that I took in 2009, which I thought was pretty interesting, you see again headed toward downtown. You see on the right is the igloo, and on the left the Council Energy Center. So very close proximity, as most of you already know. Okay, so what are the implications? What are the implications, for pro-growth agendas, of CBAs for pro-growth agendas, and for value-free growth dynamics? I think that the Pittsburgh case suggests two major implications. The first is that CBAs are actually changing redevelopment dynamics. I think that they are a novel approach to the articulation of community expectations, and I think that they are an improved approach to the involvement of the community sector in redevelopment discussions and decisions. So residents expressed the desire for the Penguins to be good neighbors, for the Penguins to be aware of the community and to not put up a symbolic or literal wall between themselves and the community. But those expectations weren't new. That's something that was already voiced in the 1950s, but what's different today is that these concerns are being formalized in an agreement. Furthermore, CBAs entail an approach that is more organized, more well-resourced, and more well-connected than past methods. in part because they do create this forum through which many organizations can work together and create one, hopefully one coalition, and then do engage in the negotiation process. Moreover, the legally binding nature of CBAs provides a means to formalize these community concerns. So a member of the coalition's negotiating team said that the legal nature of the agreement demanded the respect of other stakeholders. And so that's the first quote that I have here. I'll read it out loud. So at one point, it became clear to us that the non-community entities weren't looking at it as a binding agreement. So instead of just talking about the concepts, we started putting legal language in front of them and started drafting. And I think that was more important to get them to see a little bit more clearly. You know, we're not just talking about if you feel like it, you can do X, Y, Z. So CBAs also hold local growth coalitions accountable, I found. As one clergy member explained, CBAs inspire a dialogue about accountability that developers are unlikely to begin on their own volition. So this is his quote. He said, what developer would say, well, this is the right thing to do. We need to just give back. I know we're going and getting all this, but you know, I just can't sleep at night unless I just... It doesn't work like that. If I don't have to go through any red tape, any fighting, any obstacles, I'm in hog heaven. You know, it's confusing even for some political people. They say, why, how can you do this? You know, he said, it's our taxes, it's our land, it's our community. So the CBA is a new thing, it's maybe not the best one, but it's beginning to talk about accountability. And this notion of accountability, what I argue is that it kind of makes a switch from the notion of value-free growth to what I'm calling value-conscious growth. So it's sort of infusing into the redevelopment process a requirement that the local growth machine take into account local impacts. It's sort of forcing them to think about local impacts and community benefits. In addition, I think that CBAs have the potential, they don't always, but they have the potential to affect community organization and self-determination. So members of the CBA coalition frequently stated that the CBA acted as a means of community building, of community empowerment, and representation, and that it was a tool to build the community, and it was a tool to community building and not the other way around. In this sense, the community would be organized for the long term, and they would be ready to face future redevelopment challenges. In addition, CBA requires a small group of folks, or maybe a larger group of folks, still working together and still committed over time, because there's a monitoring and implementation process that has to happen in order for the CBA to be enforced. And then lastly, just having a seat at a conversation about redevelopment is another facet of empowerment, ideally having a seat and being listened to. So, now I'll turn sour. So this is what I think of. What is the extent of the challenge that CBAs pose for local growth coalitions and their agendas? The second major implication that I argue is that CBAs really present a challenge that stops short. So many members of the local growth coalition that I spoke with, they largely recognize CBAs as a developer burden. So CBAs for them represent an increased legal and development costs, which was a result in concerns over a decreased profit margin. And the following comment that I'm going to read is really representative of some local politicians that I spoke to at the community, the county, and the city level. And these were people who actually, some of them supported the CBA, but they would still say things like this. I think in places that are hard to develop, if you do this in such a way that it becomes even more burdensome for developers to develop, I think that you have to be careful about that. I mean, you have to be careful about, you know, accepting CBAs or negotiating CBAs. And so this type of comment, and again, he was not the only person that made a comment like this, this type of comment, I think, illustrates an unchallenged commitment to growth. Because CBAs can burden developers or they can delay development, the tool is called into question. The tool is called into question, not the fact that growth itself might be undesirable or inequitable.
Or particular forms of growth.
Yeah. Along with perceiving CBAs as burdensome to developers, some local and state politicians implied that the community involvement that CBAs entail could be problematic. So this person conceptualizes community interests in such a way that not only privileges growth, but views community center. Yeah, let me read the quote first.
Okay.
So the first quote here, he says, if you do it, this is someone from the local, I would call the local growth coalition, someone working in the county executive's office. If you do it for one community, then every time you do a major project in a neighborhood, everybody's going to be crying if they want a CBA. So where do you begin and where do you stop? So now, this person conceptualizes community interests in such a way that not only privileges growth, but that views community sector expectations as like a disturbance, something that needed to be quelled. In contrast, this person offered a really exceptional critique of political officials' understanding of CBAs in particular, and just community involvement in general. Again, an exceptional critique, something that was not very common. This person said, I think government officials have a hard time embracing CBAs because there's a feeling that this will slow the project down, that somehow this will affect our ability to sell bonds or our ability to get other approvals. And we don't want to be delayed with citizens getting involved. And this is an emphasis when he said this. The people who we represent, we don't want them getting involved in the process.
Was that an elected official?
It was.
Wow, okay.
Mm-hmm. That's why it was especially exceptional.
Was supportive
or just supportive. Supportive of CBAs, actually. Mm-hmm.
Was really expressing a personal feeling or more like a generalization?
Personal feeling. critical of colleagues,
yeah,
personal opinion, supporting CBAs.
Yeah. Yeah.
We could develop a fundraiser on, like, who said that?
The
feds
are going down.
Okay, so what's really interesting here, I think, too, is that he's kind of alluding to this alignment between the public and the private sectors, to the exclusion of the community sector. And what's super interesting is that this alignment was so strong during the Hill District CBA campaign that local government, particularly the mayor and the county executive and the Penguins, were perceived as a single entity. And so in community stakeholders that were involved in the process would often refer to this group as the other side. And so at one point, the Penguins actually justified their absence from negotiations by suggesting that the politicians represented them at the meetings. That's something that the politicians denied, but nevertheless. So even, and this is something that your comment was getting to, so even with the most successful of CBA campaigns, in cities that have strong local growth coalitions, the agreement is still a reactive tool. Communities are still sort of entering the conversation at the tail end. So in the ideal form, a developer would use a CBA to gain government approval. And those who came up with CBAs had this in mind. And in fact, in California, it's been the case a few times that the developer had to gain approval by negotiating a CBA. And that's probably more likely the case where community support is necessary because the local growth coalition is so weak. But in a city like Pittsburgh, where you have a strong local growth coalition, the reality is that there's a pre-existing alignment between the public and private sectors. And I think the fact that the Sports and Exhibition Authority, which is a local, an arm of local government, owns the arena, it already shows that, there's an alignment there. So as a tool, CBAs do incorporate community into redevelopment conversations, but they don't ultimately fundamentally change the developer-driven redevelopment model. Growth Coalition proves adaptive. So in the Pittsburgh case, what I saw was, first, the Penguins proved adaptive by isolating CBA negotiations from other community participation. So even though they conducted focus groups, they kept the CBA discussion off to the side. The CBA was not going to be a part of their conversation about the design of the new arena, for example. I also saw it in their failing to cooperate or participate in negotiations. So for several consecutive months, the Penguins didn't show up for meetings. The city and the county did show up, or they continued to communicate with the coalition throughout that period, but they engaged in stalling by postponing meetings, and they postponed replies to the community. And lastly, a way that the Growth Coalition has figured out how to adapt to a CBA is by contributing very few concrete benefits. So at the end of the day, the Penguins really did contribute very little, $1 million toward a grocery store. And I think that was different, very different from what the community had hoped up when they started the process. So my last slide here. So moving forward, the case of Pittsburgh's first CBA suggests that a larger deconstruction of growth is required to fundamentally alter dominant standards of growth or growth machine processes, everything I've described. If our goal, which mine is to incorporate greater community benefits, greater community participation, and greater consideration of those use values of land and property. And what I mean by deconstruction is basically the challenging of preconceived notions and the breaking down of taken-for-granted meetings in order to offer new ideas and ask new questions. So today's dominant growth ideology basically renders investing public funds in sports facilities as an acceptable norm. The success of cities is also measured by its profit potential, their profit potential. Thus, unequal in that atmosphere, unequal impacts of land use decisions are really of little concern. So a more fundamental deconstruction of growth would potentially incorporate new standards for growth. Measuring quality of life and city success by things like affordability of housing and services, living wage jobs, and absence of environmental hazards, those things would yield a new set of standards. This is like my pie in the sky, I admit it. But nevertheless, you know, if we had new measures of how a city is successful, you know, perhaps the gap between the wealthiest and the poorest residents, things like that, if those were how we measured the success of cities, then CBAs would actually be obsolete because developers in that atmosphere couldn't simply go where CBAs are not. They would always have to think about the community up front, and the community wouldn't enter on the tail end. I had a more fundamental deconstruction of growth taking place in Pittsburgh. I think that all of the sectors, the community, the public, and the private, would have asked, maybe they would have asked, why do we need a new arena? Or maybe they would have just asked, how can we justify this much or any public funding for this arena, particularly at the expense of other city needs? So what's very interesting is that at the same time that the discussions about the funding for the arena were taking place, community libraries were in jeopardy. So our public libraries were at risk of closing because of funding problems, and yet we're funding this arena. So to me, that's telling of where our priorities are as a city. So the task of future researchers, I think, are a few things. First, I think they could examine the implications of CBAs and other negotiation strategies for growth dynamics in other places and in other scenarios, maybe places with weaker growth coalitions, etc. Second, to further articulate the deconstruction of growth. I really only started at the end of my dissertation. And also to create more concrete ways to measure and to incorporate these new standards. And finally, I would say that we need to hear more from the growth coalition, because these are the folks that are making a lot of decisions, and these are the people that are the hardest to gain access to. So that's that. So there's my contact information, and I'm open for questions.
Good. Thanks, Molly. Open up the floor now for questions, and would you please identify yourself when you ask Colleen a question?
Long-time family friend.
How do you decide who gets a seat at the table? Does it have to be an organization?
So you mean like what did happen? Okay, so Dr. Darby or Ann, you might need to fill in. But my understanding is that basically, you know, so obviously the city and the county are going to be involved. And in some cities, the city and the county are less involved than they were in the Pittsburgh case. But in our case, you know, the city and the county obviously have a seat, and the Penguins as well, the developer. And on the community side, the coalition that formed actually had a series of requirements for how you could be considered a member. And it had to do with how long your organization was around, how many members your organization had. So basically, you signed on as a member of the coalition. You couldn't just sign on as an individual. Mm-hmm. But what they did do, and again, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but I remember that there was like, you know, we're going to create an organization that's called like the Lower Hill Organization. So for people that weren't part of an organization, they sort of formed one. And so that people who lived in that neighborhood, if there were enough of them, they sort of had like a pseudo organization so they could also come in and vote and vote.
Is that Because we wanted it to be very about the kind of things that we offer.
Okay, perfect.
Okay.
Thank you.
But I just want to say that I think that we nailed it.
Thanks.
As far as leverage and the reactive process, and the problem with the CBA, and to answer the question about why are we still fighting about it,
yeah, that's what I hear.
Is that the Penguins already received everything that they want. All the funding is already awarded by the time of the CBA negotiation and mobilization and so that just means that, and so essentially the only leverage that the coalition is able to get is really leverage against the elected officials, and that's why the CBA is really resource oriented as far as investment in the bill, $200,000 $500,000
Right, I didn't mention the MPP, because I feel like the MPP is sort of like a symbolic victory, because it really, I mean, my understanding is that the Pens connected a corporate sponsor with the neighborhood through this neighborhood partnership program, but they didn't actually become the corporate sponsor themselves.
Right, yeah.
And then it could have happened outside of the CBA.
But so the thing is, so that's why, I mean, there's not, as far as commitments to do things, commitments to Penguins made commitments to hire from the community, but they didn't require developers to buy generators to there was funding for a master plan, but the Penguins never made any commitments to actually buy generators. Right? And so that's a function of the reactive nature of this entire process.
Yeah.
Thank you for kind of making that your essential.
Yeah. And one thing, I'm just going to piggyback on what you said, is I think I forgot to mention in the one slide, but the other part is that the master plan, the city planning board approved the arena master plan without a CBA. And that's where in some cities what's happened is that the CBA has been like a leverage point where the government said, the planning board says, like, we won't approve your project until there's a CBA as part of it. But that didn't happen in Pittsburgh. And furthermore, someone went to a basketball game. Someone on the planning commission left and went to a Pitt basketball game, and came back to the meeting later on. So that shows just how important the CBA was to that process.
But there's a question whether they could actually, whether the planning commission could actually require the CBA as a condition.
That's true. That's true.
Yeah. Needs to be amended to essentially define.
That's true.
To include a CBA as.
We'll start with you to go around the table.
Just a couple to touch on the front end. I think one important feature for folks who use research is for documents stuff, like school management, etc. But on the front end, for people who do the work sitting right here, the school, the key factor was you got progressive people on the ground and some progressive funders. Particularly Terry O'Donnell, one of the big funders, shouldn't be leaving out of the negotiated with some other funders who weren't willing to go to this stuff to support the CBA model. In other words, if you want to learn more about this, then you need to go into a real national organization model that was, you know, we tried to incorporate and get paid through. And it was propagated by a group of Pittsburgh United. So you had a group that went into the world and said, let's try to do this here, have allies all over the back, and try to apply a model. And that model was very much a form of union organizing, like historic labor organizing. Like, you sit at the table and you negotiate, not just stand inside a protest. And then other things that come to the fore. And I would say, for spin-off, in spite of a lot of differences, you see a lot more of that kind of thinking. Like just even, I mean, the whole UPMC has allies that actually can perform sort of to Pittsburgh United. So this has had a great spin-off, but the victors are.
Yeah, so again, changing redevelopment dynamics.
A quick little note about the power machine. The guy who went to the basketball game during that vote was someone who was the lead person who was the head of the biggest development in East Liberty. It's now tipping, is the tipping point of the high-end development versus, you know, the mixed. So these folks move from one place to another.
Yeah.
You know, they're involved in everything.
Yeah.
And they would be funding our behavior and assistance and staff to be able to keep up with what we're doing. Mm-hmm. So, key issue. You know, so it's that long-term process.
Yeah, so as you were mentioning, there was foundation influence and foundation funding for this particular CBA. I honestly, in other cities, I know that the foundations have been involved. I know that in California, some of them have stemmed out of a particular nonprofit organization, and so I'm not sure where it gets its funding from. But it helped to fund the new part. I think what are they called? The ones in California.
I'm
new. What is it? Yes, that's actually what I'm thinking of. I think they might be headed in California. That I couldn't answer. I don't know how much they're receiving.
But it did cover all of the energy that went
into it. No. Definitely not.
I just want to point out, the community coalition itself didn't receive
anything. Right.
The allies. There's a network of allies called Pittsburgh United, which is still around. That was a coalition of community organizations, labor organizations, environmental organizations, and faith-based organizations. And they provided sort of support for one another. And they received some funding to increase the research.
And printing and copying and, you know, basic stuff like that. That's my impression as well.
Great. What's the mechanism by which CPAs become legally?
And I'm gonna refer to the lawyers on that one. Yeah, because there are definitely there's actually a guy named Julian Gross who wrote a great article on whether or not they how they can be enforceable, the problems with enforceability. So I'm not a lawyer, so I can't go into any detail. But people are questioning how enforceable they actually are, and because they're not super new, they're not super old, so we don't have a really long history of knowing how enforceable they are. But you lawyers may have something to add. Yeah.
But my comment to that is, if it was not for the aging community and the people through it, we wouldn't get some of the things that we have. Mm-hmm. And the meeting 2 weeks ago, it wasn't a problem.
Okay.
We didn't consider the policy. But another thing that I don't want to overlook is the fact there are windows on the center avenue side of the Tesla manager that would not be there.
Mm-hmm.
If it wasn't, other people would be there.
Mm-hmm.
And they had to change the architecture of the building. And that would so that they could look at it. Possible.
Remember that discussion.
I also have an observation that we may have taken into account somewhere in the research that the stadiums and points all on that. There are naming rights and clearing rights and all sorts of other rights that bring revenue onto the table. And who gets those if it's a big question.
My impression is that the team does, but I'm not positive. Yeah.
Yeah. Then you go to the team and say, who's the best caterer in the community? It's a really good caterer.
Yeah.
Go to Ann and then back to you.
So, Ann
first, and then.
Oh, sorry.
So,
Daryl, identify yourself.
Oh, right.
Daryl Rapp. I'm actually on borough council in Swissvale, a small town. And a little town doesn't have the potential for a stadium, but, you know, we are struggling, you know, with the idea of redevelopment.
Yeah.
And trying to attract investment. And my question is related to the comment of the one politician about kind of where do you stop?
Yeah.
You know, here is a massive investment, $320 million. But if a small contractor wants to renovate a house, you can't have a community benefits agreement for the redevelopment, the rehab of a single house. So, but that is an investment in a community. So where in that whole spectrum does it become valuable enough to go through this process, which I think is important, and I could see some of my colleagues saying, we don't care as long as there is some investment, we'll take anything.
Yeah. Yeah.
So so it's just a theoretical idea of how to engage this process properly well to get some good benefits to the community and not just, I'll take anything.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, my only thought about that is that in that case, what you're describing, I would hardly picture a community deciding to invest all its energy in like this redevelopment of a house, because it's not necessarily going to impact them, small or large or negatively, really. And with the arena, a lot of the impetus behind the organizing that I saw was that it had to do with retribution for the past, but also this is another large-scale development. Granted, they already dealt with the arena, existing arena, but this is another large-scale development going in. I don't, in any of the CVs that I've read about, none of them have been about such a small thing like you described. They're all big things. They're things like arenas and stadiums, like big hospitals, things that like people know that there's a lot of public funding going in and there's a lot of money circulating around them to begin with. So that's the only part that I'm really confident about.
I have an observation on that. Communities have codes, zoning codes, and they could also institute development agreements.
Yes.
And include almost anything they want.
Yes.
If the developer wants to do something.
But communities can be pressured to smaller developers too.
Sure.
To build smaller buildings.
Mm-hmm.
So,
sure.
Some green spaces and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I just haven't seen a CBA on such a
small scale.
Not a
CBA, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But Anne?
What we can't do yet is that in order for a CBA to come into play, the issue to be there is that, you demand some public tax dollars are being given to private developers. It's the tax money that gives the community, so to speak. I came today because of my friendship that developed with Colleen, and I really wish I hadn't come. It's so upsetting to, well, first of all, my name is Anne Sims. I lived in a hill district since 1968. I own a building at Wally Avenue. I live there, and I practice there. It is half a block in Peloponne, my building is to the Parker Road, which has been vacant and vandalized for many years now. It's just constructed. At any rate, I was on the negotiating team from the Hill, and I really believed in what we were trying to do. I am still fully connecting dots about what happened there, and none of it is clean, none of it is, it's just a bit more untrue, but really. It's true that foundations gave seed money to support the people who started the organization.
Well, a certain people, so that's actually
good. Well,
others did, but certain people said, I'm going to take a risk to do something.
Yeah, they supported the people in the Hill who started the CBA movement, so to
speak. Well, my understanding is they seeded Pittsburgh United they did something that many funders wouldn't do, which is they agreed to do something to a legal challenge. That was a big trigger.
completely. You can cast it as you kind of don't play persuasion, and you give it a little money for it as a treat. So I was actually saying that would be neat for those who are funding for these kids up started. That doesn't mean they're good, they're really good.
But let's let Anne finish her view.
Yeah.
Thanks.
So that happened and it was a very good thing. But the tragedy of that was that the people who got this funding money, in the end, before the community at large became involved, they had already cut the majority of the Penguins and the politicians. And that's the bottom line. And the rest of the community was used and manipulated, and there was this false charade that the community was really involved. And that was the huge tragedy. Because those of us in the negotiating team really didn't know that. And so we thought, you know, we were really negotiating something, but the deal had already been cut. And Bob made it, you know, a good one. The SEA already had their contract. It was this that took them a long time to read. They already had their contract with the Penguins. So their deal was already cut. You know, the mayor had already gotten on the Penguins airplane and flown up to New York. And that contract was, and is, despicable, because it gave the Penguins everything. They get all the revenue from the department still, and they get, if the circus comes to the Civic Arena, they get all the proceeds of any event that's held in the center, in the concert or in the center. Any event that's held, any concert, anything, in addition to human games, all the revenue goes to the Penguins. Period.
And no cost to the police or the other costs. The city picks up. It's all a negative for the city.
The other thing is, the casino is supposed to, their revenue is supposed to go to the state to pay for programs for seniors. But you saw Colin's figures. You know, they're contributing millions of dollars really to help the Penguins pay the rent. So this whole operation took tax money that belongs to the people from two different avenues. It took it from the casino, and then the money that was just $300 million that was just given to them. So that's sort of a larger, you know, larger picture. There's one other member of the team. And he and I sort of became real participants. Back in the 60s, he had been one of the black men from the Hill that had become a member of the trade unions. And this is where it really got coming. And because our fight was, his and mine, was to get minorities in the Hill District and the whole area to become places in the 23 trade unions. And at the time that we were negotiating, I learned that only three of the 23 trade unions, only three, had any minorities in their apprenticeship training programs. None. None. Three. Only three. And when I brought that up in a negotiating session, I think it was the one where we spent half the night downtown on a Sunday night, when I said that to the county executive, I will never forget, I was sitting across from him, and he pounded his fist on the table, and he started asking his assistants sitting on both sides of him if that was true. He was incensed beyond belief. Because the county had been giving, you know, several $1 million every year for apprenticeship training programs. And so he was upset. and I had great respect for him being upset at that time. At any rate, part of the One Source Center, which I named, I'll just have to be brag about that, half of the One Source Center was supposed to be to recruit and prepare minorities from the dead to be positioned and eligible to take the test to be in the various apprenticeship training programs. They had to be drug-free, they had to have transportation, they had to have either a hospital diploma or a GED. And so we did a lot of research. What was the place in the north? We went to Bigfoot.
Big Stacks.
Big Stacks. There were people in, you know, in the country, out in California, that had successfully done this. And so we learned like how this could be done. And had all of the things plugged in. And that is why I signed the person who voted to create it. And that never happened. That never happened. That aspect of the community benefits agreement was totally ignored by the people in the middle. Never became part of the One Source Center, and period, the end, never did. And, you know, in retrospect, the reason is logical, because the trade unions support the politicians with contributions, and in this area, in this city, they do not want minorities in the trade unions. Period. The end. They don't. They do not. And they do whatever they can to keep them out. And that is what broke my heart. Made me sick. And
now I'm broken again. Your presence.
I'm sorry.
It's broken again.
No.
I'm sitting here. I'm sorry.
But that's... I'm sorry to be so outspoken, but then again I'm not, because I don't know who all of you are. I assume that your patient members, your students, your staff, people somewhere. And there's probably nothing you can do about any of this except, you know, becoming real. But the tragedy to me was I talked to the people in California. One of the first benefits agreements in the country was from the airlines. And what they did there was just incredible. I mean, they had people in the community employed, they were trained, and they had, and they did this in New York, and community benefits agreements in New York too. They devised a system where if there were not minority contractors who were big enough or capable of becoming, you know, huge contractors. So they would say to a general contractor, I'm looking at Bob's, whether he nods or not, because Bob knows all this. They had an agreement that the huge contractors would take in small minority contractors as subcontractors. And that way they included minority business companies in the construction. So not only was that important, in addition to having minorities learning how and contributing to the building of the Consul Energy Center, it would also have benefited minority contractors, if they're not that many of them, but who were struggling, you know, to survive and to become successful.
And to get in, stay in the game.
And to stay in the game, yes. That's all. Just.
And we appreciate your candor. No, that's not a lot. We're going to go ahead and do that. Then we'll come back.
No, we won't come back.
No. We'll get some new people in, but they really appreciate it.
My name is Kathy Stanley. I'm from the Transition. And I have a couple questions. I mean, the one is similar to Daryl's, like, where is the cutoff point for CBAs, like, in terms of pricing and development? Because I see it in in East Liberty, you can say it wasn't, you know, wasn't big enough for CGA, but there's so much development that has happened, you know, in sequence, one right after the other. Maybe a CGA would have been worth it in the long run. But I guess if it makes if it makes Ian, right, and feel any better, I mean, I honestly think that the way that these kids improve and get better is just to keep doing it, suggesting them, keep doing it, because having worked for an MPO in transportation planning, rolling out public dollars, I'm telling you, this happens constantly. And if you stand back and do nothing, then it'll just continue to happen. And, you know, I go to work every day, and some days it's like not as easy as the next day, because you see what happens. And try to do the right thing, and the politicians come in and change. So I think the only thing that, you know, we can do is just keep plugging at it. And if, you know, every CBA, I guess, that must have gets negotiated in Pittsburgh, it will be better.
I think that
I see it was very positive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's not perfect, but
yeah.
We just, you know, oh, we're going to see the radar. We do have a wonderful thing.
Yeah.
I didn't know it had a business.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it caused a housing crisis because, yeah, and you know, they were promised housing. I think the other thing is that people are getting smarter in the sense that they're like, well, if you're promising us that, let's put it in writing, because I don't believe it.
One more comment? Go ahead.
The concept of CBAs is really a revolution of policy. And I would love to see it in the laws in all over the country. But the bottom line is this: people in minority communities with millions of dollars of tax money are building huge things, big businesses. You know, they're not asking for any money, or they shouldn't be. They shouldn't be, you know, for just because we live in the country doesn't give us. And that's wrong. You know, that's really wrong. But it is an opportunity that minorities have to build their businesses, to become involved in the construction, you know, to become members of the trade unions, the larger picture. It's not about, you know, asking for a handout so, you know, we'll stop being troublemakers so you can go ahead and build your work. You know, that's the bottom
line. Okay, well, one more and then Bob will end with you. Go ahead.
I wanted to ask, so I like this idea of having different measurement system.
Yeah.
They were suggesting specifically for cities to adopt that as a requirement for developers?
No, I guess mine is like,
or?
It's much more pie in the sky. I mean, it's just like, right now, we measure cities' success by one thing, and that is the property potential. They measure the city, how many areas they have, etc. I guess, generally speaking, I understand people in this room probably don't, but I think generally we think of a city as awesome if it has a lot of areas or a lot of money or whatever. But something that you don't hear about is maybe like, have you heard of like the Gini coefficient, right? So coefficient that shows level of inequality between or the wealth gap between the richest and the poorest residents, and that's a good way to characterize it. So like, what if we knew we were aware of city Gini coefficients, and that's what we said, like, that's an awesome city because they have a really narrow gap between the richest and the poorest. Yeah, exactly. So. Yeah, so like, again, this is just kind of an idea that I'm coming up with at the end of it, so I haven't really thought through it entirely, but that's kind of what I mean, it's kind of like, on a I don't know how you exactly implement it. I think that like lead standards actually do start to implement it. So they kind of, you know, they say like the community, they do start to incorporate standards for developers. So you get sort of more points, so to speak, if you, are connecting your developer to the community. So that's kind of like one way that new standards can take hold. That is like one of those.
Bob, and then we'll wrap up here.
I think CBAs are inherently, and getting back to your client side, what would be a lot more beneficial, are we building into a system of problems, community benefits, and so, for instance, you know, Anne was talking about apprenticeship training and support for businesses. You know, getting something meaningful on a deal-by-deal basis is really tough.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost impossible to do. And you can, you know, get some short-term employment and maybe some good MBE contracting numbers. But getting structural change on a deal-by-deal basis is really tough to do. What you need is a system-wide approach, right? This is a policy shift. And, you know, on the thing about affordable housing in the lower hill, I mean, that should be to lead that to a community group to try to generate enough pressure over a developer that has an inside track and that already got all the funding they need to deal with that. Is not the way decision should be made. And before that developer got development rights to the lower hill, those kinds of things should have been in place.
Again, the timing is off.
What do we want to see built here?
Mm-hmm.
What's the value? Right? Are we really, is mixed income housing only good in places like East Liberty that uses a justification for getting good companies out of the business, not the community that has some problem potential? Or is mixed income housing a value that we apply citywide, including in places like the lower hill, which is going to be one of the highest in the state level in the city. And so the problem is that these decisions aren't being made at any kind of policy level. All these decisions are kind of forced into this kind of deal by deal reactive approach to try to get some good.
And there's someone named William Poe, and he's a lawyer. He's written about just that, so I had to take it a step further. but he does talk about systematizing and putting into policy the idea of community benefits agreement at the front end of the family.
Colleen, I want to thank you. I think this was a great group. We're happy to stick around, but I know it's the end of our time.
And her work,
Bob's got
this book that's been sitting on my shelf that I bought a while ago. It's the Allegheny Conference. And it's got the original arena plans in there.
I've seen them.
Yeah.
I've seen
them. Very appropriate. That's good.
Thanks
a lot.